particular leaving party on Tuesday evening. Well, maybe more predictably pleasant than spectacular. You know how these Chilbury events are. Everyone was there, including Hattie and Mama, who were both taking pregnancy in such different ways. Hattie all excitement and joy, and Mama with a weepy hope that she'll get a boy for Daddy. Mr. Slater stubbornly refuses to be tempted by me. He skillfully redirects any questions and provokingly ignores any flirtation. Your idea of showing him some suitable landscapes might hold some opportunities. I'm formulating a plan that cannot fail. Henry asked me to marry him again. Obviously, I was vague. I can't bear to let the poor man down every 6 months. When will he get the message? Meanwhile, Kitty pathetically hangs on his every word. He politely fobs her off, which is rather cruel, don't you think? Hattie is preparing the schoolchildren for her departure when the baby arrives. In typical Hattie fashion, she's enormously guilty about the whole thing, and feels that it's frightfully selfish to be having a baby. Don't be silly, Hattie. You're a born mother. You can't pass that up just to teach a few schoolchildren, I tell her. But she only says, You don't know how much they depend on me, Venetia. You don't understand. Clearly, I don't. The new choir mistress, Prim, made an extraordinary announcement at choir practice on Wednesday, and everyone's up in arms once again. She surged in with her usual melodrama, but instead of handing out music scores, she quickly climbed the pulpit, and we knew something special was afoot. I have entered the Chilbury Ladies' Choir into a public choir competition in Lichfield 3 weeks from Saturday. What in heaven's name are you thinking? Mrs. B stood up and strode over with the determination of a tank. We're not parading any nonsensical women's choir in a public competition. We'd be a laughing stock. The competition is in aid of weapon production and is considered a tremendous boost for home front morale, Prim said jubilantly. It'll be in all the papers, cheering spirits across the country. I can't imagine anyone will be thinking badly of us. All over the country? Mrs. B thundered, the stained glass windows jittering. Our respectable historic village will be dragged into the national press. She took out her ticking-off finger and began wagging it fiercely. Are we to find ourselves shut out of polite society? Now, don't be a spoilsport, Mrs. B. I stepped forward, smiling sweetly. Everyone will think us wonderfully modern. And it would be so much fun to perform on a stage, wouldn't it? Kitty added. What complete and utter tosh! Mrs. B. snapped. We'll look absurd. A bunch of women muddling along without any men? Where's your sense of pride? Then a strange thing happened. Hattie came forward. I know you want everything to stay the same, Mrs. B., but there's a war on, and we're trying to get on as best as we can. There are no rules about singing without men. In fact, there are no rules about anything anymore. So let's be amongst the first to herald this new opportunity. It's part of the home front effort to keep spirits up after all, she went on. So we're doing our bit for the war simply by entering. Count me in, Mrs. Quayle called over from the organ. I'm in, said Mrs. Gibbs, and another voice spoke out. Let's give it a go. Yes, let's give it all we've got, Mrs. Tilling said cautiously. Just because we've never done something before, it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Mrs. B, pouting like a restrained child, wasn't ready to step down.
Has everyone lost their minds around here? Not at all.
Prim spread her arms wide with pride.
We may be a late entry, but I know that we have what it takes. We have some great voices. Kitty and Venetia are already first-class sopranos, and Mrs. Tilling is the mainstay in the altos. Everyone has a fine voice, but to compete against the big choirs, we have to use our finest asset, the one that will mark us out as truly exceptional.
She looked from person to person.
Music is about passion. It's about humanity. We need to bring our own passions to our voices.
She wound her baton thoughtfully through the air.
We have to imbue every note, every word, with our own stories. Think of what our members can bring. Kitty's exuberance, Sylvie's courage, Mrs. Quail's joviality, Hattie's gentleness, Mrs. Tilling's diligence. Even you, Mrs. B, bring a gusto and verve to our singing. Every joy, every pain we are feeling from this war will be put to use in our music.
She paused momentarily. That, plus an extra practice on Fridays. Mrs. B looked annoyed.
Where is the competition to be held?
Prim leant forward dramatically, speaking in a theatrical whisper.
Lichfield Cathedral, probably the most spiritual and inspiring edifice of them all. The acoustics are amongst the finest in the country, and if we win, we'll be in the finals in none other than St. Paul's Cathedral in London.
That sounds jolly grand, Kitty beamed. Let's try and win, shall we?
She went over to Mrs. B.
Go on, Mrs. B. You'll help us, won't you?
I suppose I may as well give you my support.
She sniffed petulantly.
Only because it's for the war, mind you.
I knew she wouldn't be able to stay away, although she stepped haughtily back to the choir stalls, like they smelt of horse manure, shooting Mrs. Tilling a look of disgust. Prim sifted through a pile of sheet music and began to hand it around.
Righty-ho! We're going to start with a new piece for the competition.
The sheets went around, and we all shuddered.
Ave Maria, she began,
is a prayer to the Virgin Mary,
calling for her divine help in a time of war. I have arranged the piece especially for our choir. Are we ready to try it?
We gave it the best shot we could. Then she took each part through. First, the sopranos, then the altos. I could tell that Prim was delighted.
You see, you made the most glorious sound. I have no doubts now that, with some more practice, we will make it work wonderfully. We can stand together and strong, and be a force to be reckoned with.
At the end, Prim mentioned that if anyone would like to try a solo, she should step forward to audition.
There are two verses in the arrangement, so two different voices are required. Do we have any takers?
Kitty was there in a trice.
I'll do it.
I couldn't let Kitty have all the glory, so I stepped forward too.
I'm sure I can give it a good go.
Prim waited a few minutes, then raised her voice over the throng.
How about you, Mrs. Tilling? Don't you think you have voice enough to share with the world?
She blushed, picked up her handbag, and came over.
Do you really think I could?
Well, that's up to you,
Prim said.
You certainly have the voice.
But do you have the nerve? A flush went over Mrs. Tilling's gaunt cheeks. Prim went over and had a word with Mrs. Quail at the organ, then returned to us.
We're going to hear you sing the first verse one at a time.
Mrs. Tilling looked like she might faint, while Kitty simply couldn't wait.
Kitty, why don't you go first?
Prim said, and motioned to Mrs. Quail to start playing. Kitty sang like she was on stage in front of several thousand adoring opera-goers. She raised her eyes to the ceiling when hitting those tricky high notes, and even did that awful warbling sound. It was ghastly.
Bravo!
Prim gushed at the end, and I wondered if she was being tactful until Mrs. Tilling joined in.
What a beautiful voice you have, Kitty!
Kitty grinned in an infuriating manner. I was considering backing out, except Prim quickly decided it was my turn. Mrs. Quail already playing the introduction.
I sang as well as I could, stumbling over a few words and not hitting the top notes quite as well as Kitty. But really, my voice is so much nicer than hers, much more natural sounding. At the end, Prim and Mrs. Tilling gave a small round of applause and agreed that I had a lovely mellow voice. Kitty looked smugly on, thinking she'd won. Then it was Mrs. Tilling's turn, and we know that she sings terrifically well, has done since we can remember. Without her, the choir would have been in a lot of trouble. She sang perfectly in tune, all the words right, never wavering from her enchanting alto tone.
"Wonderful, Mrs. Tilling," Prim said. "The perfect voice for one of our solos."
Then she looked at me, the inevitable coming.
"And I'm afraid, Venetia, that I'm going to pick Kitty this time. We'll need some extra work, and I imagine she has a lot more time than you do with the War Office job."
"Yes, you're completely right," I said. "I shouldn't have auditioned, really, as I don't have any spare time these days. Maybe next time." And with that, seeing Kitty delightedly jumping up and down in the corner of my eye, I got my coat and walked majestically out of the building. Since then, Kitty's been lording it over me ad nauseam. Sylvie and I had to retire to my bedroom to escape. I did her hair up beautifully while she tried on my lipstick. She's such a sweet creature. On that note, I must away to get my beauty sleep. I will let you know how my plan to get Mr. Slater proceeds. Success will be mine. Venetia.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Saturday, 27th of April, 1940. The question of Venetia's virginity. Why is it that just when you think you know how everything works, something explodes right under your nose and you have to rethink it all through? There was I, merrily going through life thinking that no one did anything except perhaps one or two kisses before they got married. And then, boom, I see the whole act unfold in front of my very eyes. Things I would dearly like to know. Was Venetia as pure as the driven snow, as we've always been taught to be? Will she have to marry Mr. Slater now? Will this mean she'll stop playing her evil games with Henry? Does anyone else do this before they're married? Will I have to? First of all, let me state that as far as I was concerned, before I saw what I did, Venetia was still a virgin. Mama told both of us that one has to stay a virgin until one gets married, and I must say it has never crossed my mind to question this instruction. I've seen plenty of copulation before, so don't think I'm naive. Bulls mounting cows in the fields. That time Mr. Dawkins brought his mare over for Amadeus to get her pregnant. And the dogs in the stables are at it all the time. And I know what it leads to. Babies. So why was Venetia doing it? She's not married, and as far as I know, she doesn't want a baby. It was disgusting. Then I wondered if she'd done it with anyone else. And a cloud of memories flew into my head like a photograph album of every boy she's ever toyed with. Now that I came to think about it, she could have done it with any of them. Cecil Worthing, David Tilling, even Victor Lovell, or, heaven forbid, Henry. They'd known each other since they were children, grew up as friends, spent many evenings together at parties, perhaps sneaking out into the night for a quiet kiss that may have led to more. Maybe this was her awful hold over them. Could Venetia be a harlot? Angela Quayle is most definitely a harlot. I'm sure she did it with Edmund, as they were always touching each other in a most embarrassing way. I think she wanted to be with Henry, too, because she always seemed odd around him, all fluttery. I wonder if he rejected her and chose me instead because he likes proper girls, and Angela wears her depravity like a badge of honour. I suppose being the vicar's daughter has made her more unruly. But with Venetia, Daddy would hit the roof. It all started after my singing lesson with Prim this afternoon, which had gone particularly well, as she told me that I had perfect pitch. I couldn't wait to tell Sylvie, and since she wasn't at home, I trotted off to the stables to see if she was there. It was such a delicious day, all buttery and golden, and I felt as if the world made complete sense. The cherry blossom was just past its best, and pink and white petals cascaded over me as I crossed through the orchard. It was wondrous, like it was snowing tiny soft cushions. As I passed through the whiffy stable yard, I thought I heard voices by Amadeus's door. For a brief moment, I wondered if Venetia had taken a funny turn and decided to pay her old horse a bit of attention. She's completely neglected him since she stopped dressage. No such luck. It was Venetia's voice, all right. But she wasn't talking to Amadeus. I stood on tiptoe to look through a gap in the wooden door and had the perfect view of Mr. Slater, immaculate in grey suit and tie. He looked incredibly out of place in the stable setting, which ponged of sweaty horses and saddle leather. I would have been surprised to see him there, had it not been for Venetia's little bet with Angela. But this didn't seem like a little bet at all. She was standing close to him, looking up at him in the most ridiculous way, her blonde hair swept to the side and over one shoulder. Even from where I stood, the gusto of her peachy perfume overpowered the sinewy whiff of manure. She was wearing a dress I've never seen before. It was sunflower yellow and shone like silk, with a flowing skirt and low in the front, exposing her cleavage with startling fullness. A white cardigan was draped around her smooth shoulders, making her look young. Playful kitten one minute, conniving minx the next. "What do you have for me?" she said, standing before him inches away.
"Do you deserve anything?"
he asked with a strange half-smile on his handsome lips, one eyebrow raised.
"Maybe,"
she giggled, twirling her hips so that the gleaming skirt slunk around his legs for a moment and then cascaded back around hers. He slid his hand into his inside pocket and slipped out a package. She took it and stood away, laughing, opening it. I wanted her to get on and rip it open, but she wavered and hesitated, opening and then closing, running her forefinger over and under the brown paper packaging in a ludicrous way. Eventually, she pulled out a pair of stockings, holding them up in the dim light. Two sheens of slender brown gauze moving gently in the still air, transparent in the dappled light of the dusty window. With careful deliberation, she took one shoe off, standing as she was in the middle of the small stable, and, casting one of the stockings at him, she slipped the other onto her foot and up over her ankle. I felt instantly uncomfortable, as did Mr. Slater, who turned away, busying himself with folding the stocking he held in his hand. "What do you think of that?" She prompted him to look as she drew the top over her knee and rucked up her dress to pull it up. He glanced down, and I saw his eyes engage with her long, smooth thigh, now half covered with the stocking, beige-brown below and pearly-white skin above.
"They'll do well enough," he said, looking away. But his eyes strayed back to her as she kicked off her other shoe.
"Give me the other one," she breathed, and he handed her the other stocking. She unfurled it, letting it cascade down in front of her, and then she raised her foot and slipped it over, shimmying the beige haze up her other leg. Again she rucked up her dress, this time to show a white lace garter, to which she carefully attached the top of the stocking. You could even see a glimpse of her undergarments as she brazenly displayed herself in front of him.
"I don't think you should be doing that," he said.
He hadn't turned away this time. He was just standing there watching, immersed. "I wanted to let you see what they look like. A kind of thank you gift." She stood up straight but held the skirt of her dress up so that he could view his gift in full glory. See what I mean about her poise, as if she's played every step before. Then she slipped her shoes back on and raised her skirt a touch higher, placing one foot in front of the other like some kind of actress or showgirl.
"I told you better leave me be," he answered, his voice slipping out of his usual witty upper-class front, his hand pushing back through his hair. Then he recollected himself and added with a half-smile, "Or I might not be a perfect gentleman." She smirked, a look of determination in her eyes. This was the problem with Venetia. She could never see herself beaten. She wanted Slater, regardless of the price. She took a step towards him and took his hand. I couldn't see what happened next as she now had her back to me, but I think she must have put his hand on her thigh. "Venetia," he whispered, "do you know what you're doing?" "Yes," she replied, velvet self-assurance in her voice. "I know exactly what I'm doing."
"I don't think you do."
He lowered his face and kissed her extremely forcefully indeed, his other hand coming around the back of her pale shoulders, pulling her in towards him. They stood locked, writhing like that against each other for a few minutes, and then, I have no idea how, they eased themselves onto the hay without stopping kissing. I couldn't see them as the hole in the door was too narrow, but I knew what they were doing. Like animals in a stable. Flinging myself out of the yard, I decided to go back home and do some thinking about what I just saw, which is where you find me now. None of my questions seemed to be answered, but I now know some things for sure. Things I know for sure. Venetia has almost certainly done this before. She might have done it more than once before, too, although didn't have a baby. She might have done it with Henry, which is why he follows her around. Angela Quayle has clearly done it, vicar's daughter or not. Now that I come to think of it, there is a lot more of it going on than I thought. I'm still not going to do it until I'm married. Venetia is more serious about Mr. Slater than I thought. Or Daddy thought, for that matter. Daddy will be furious if he ever finds out. This piece of information might come in very useful. With that, I've decided to close the matter. Although the image of her standing there is etched onto my mind. How come she's got it into her mind she can do these things, when we've been told that we can't? Then I realized, it's the war. No one cares anymore about saving ourselves for marriage. It's all about the here and now, letting everything go, enjoying life while we can. Virginity is old hat because we could be dead tomorrow, or worse, be occupied by the Nazis. That said, I'm not sure I fancy the idea of doing it that much, so I think I'll just keep mine for now. I'll have to perfect my solo so that I can become so famous and successful that I never have to think about Venetia and her disgusting little affairs ever again.
Letter from Miss Edwina Pawtry to her sister Clara. 3 Church Road, Chilbury, Kent. Friday, 3rd of May, 1940. Dear Clara, you have a champion for a sister. Triumphant is how I am, as it wasn't easy, like Hercules getting through the ruddy 12 labours, except that it was only 2 screaming babies being swapped. But I wasn't going to let that reward run away from me. Not this time, Clara, let me tell you the whole. After a good breakfast, spent watching Mrs. Tilling, smartly dressed in her ghastly green WVS uniform, arrive and then depart from Hattie's house for her usual morning check, I gathered my black bag and moved into the first part of my plan, feeding Hattie the potion. "Anybody in?" I called as I knocked at the door and pushed it ajar, putting on the most friendly voice I could muster. "Hattie? It's me, Miss Pawtry. Are you upstairs?"
"In the kitchen,"
she chanted in her sing-song voice. I walked in to find her pottering around the tiny room, surrounded by soil-coated vegetables dug up from the garden, a sizable leek in one hand.
"I'm glad I found you in," I smiled. "I saw a midwife friend in Faversham yesterday, and the most remarkable coincidence. I was telling her about your tiredness, and how there was nothing you could take for it. and she told me about a new remedy. She said she's been giving it out for months, and every woman has been so happy that she's quite run out of the stuff.
Can I get it anywhere?
Hattie turned, putting down the leak. I haven't been able to get out for days now, and I need to visit the children in Litchfield Hospital. I've been giving them extra lessons in my spare time, and... As it happened, she received a new box while I was there, and I begged her to let me have some for you.
You did? How marvellous!
She took a few steps towards me in eagerness, fixing a thick strand of dark hair that had slipped out of its pins.
How much do I owe you?
It was quite pricey, dear, because it's so much in demand, I said, putting my head on one side to add an extra cheeriness. But I'll give you a special price of threepence halfpenny for the dose. She got some change from her purse and handed me a few coins. I checked the money. It was a halfpenny short, but I decided not to press her for it. And then I took the brown bottle out of my bag, along with a teaspoon.
How much do I have to take?
She took the bottle and eyed it, her rosy mouth pinched with fear. A teaspoon will do the trick. Let me pour it out for you. I took the bottle and got her a glass of water. There's nothing like having a proper midwife to help you with these things. I stepped back to open the mixture, as the smell can knock you out. Breathing through my mouth, I poured the globuled liquid, and a faint green-grey effervescence lifted off as the smell of dog meat and motor oil crept up my nostrils unaware. I handed it over.
Are you sure?
She dithered, grimacing at the powerful concoction. I know it doesn't look appetizing, but what medicines do? I eased her elbow up, lifting the spoon towards her mouth, and down it jolly well went. She turned rather green, and I worried she might throw up or worse, faint. It wasn't an official medication as such, and I'd heard about some of the side effects. Internal bleeding, convulsions, coma. And for a moment she gasped for air, and her eyes seemed to pass backward into her head. I sat her down, before she fell, and patted her heartily on the back, and at last she choked violently and seemed more herself, clutching the bottle like it was a blooming lifesaver. I stayed with her a few minutes, trying to get the bottle away. I wasn't going to leave any evidence for that interfering Tilling woman to examine. In the end, I had to grab it and run, as time was moving fast.
"But, Miss Bawdrey, I feel something happening,"
she gasped, grabbing my hand. "Early days, early days," I said kindly, yanking my hand away and running for the door. "You see, I had to get the Winthrop baby out quick, before this one gave birth. It was all a matter of timing, and I wasn't letting pleasantries get in my way." I rushed out and strode up to the Winthrop house. To get to Childry Manor, you only need to cross the green and the square and take the lane up to the driveway. It's 10 minutes on a usual day, 5 if you're in a hurry, less if you run. Hopefully it wouldn't come to that. Elsie met me at the side door, looking alarmingly dishevelled, hair falling out from under her cap.
"I don't know if I can watch the baby for you. I mean, if I had to," she said. "Nelly Godwin stays in her quarters in the mornings, and there's no one else about. I don't know if I'd be able to get away."
"You must," I urged, taking her slim wrist and digging my grubby nails into the soft underside. A gasp of pain escaped her.
"I'll do what I can."
"You'll explain that it's for the baby's sake, your duty as a servant." She looked bewildered, and as I followed her upstairs, I let out a sigh, thinking, God help me if the idiot girl ruins the whole thing. Wimpy Mrs. Winthrop took the medicine without any qualms, only grateful that I should be thinking of her. Since it was her fourth child, labour began almost instantly, and the child's head was peeking out before Elsie had got back with the hot water. There was a moment, I recall, where I wondered if luck would be with me, and it would be male. But before I could even cross my fingers, the baby was born, and as she plopped out in front of me, my eyes homed in on the ominous lack of boy parts.
"It's a boy!"
I announced, containing my disappointment while snipping the cord and swiftly swaddling the baby in a blanket. I tried to be fast so Elsie wouldn't see, but as I turned, there she was, a look of anguish on her face.
"But it's a girl,"
she said quiet-like. "No, Elsie," I said through gritted teeth, "it's a boy." I frowned at her and jerked my head towards the door, and I saw her eyes narrowing as the penny dropped. Luckily, the lady didn't hear Elsie.
"It's a boy," she cried meekly. "Thank God, it's a boy."
"But he's having trouble breathing," I gasped, trying not to make it sound rehearsed. "I have a mechanical ventilator at my house. I'll have to rush him away quickly. This maid can come with me. Will the nanny be able to help with the afterbirth?" Elsie ran off to get the nanny, and I was left with Mrs. Winthrop begging me to see the child.
"Please, please, I want to see my baby."
"No, no, no, Mrs. Winthrop, I need to get him away as soon as I can." She just kept on and on. Luckily, she wasn't strong enough to haul herself out of bed, or else I'd have been in trouble. Elsie returned promptly with the old nanny, who looked both tired and dismayed. I told her about the afterbirth, clamped the baby to my chest, and darted down the stairs and out the door. As I strode down to the village, Elsie trotted along beside me, asking pointless questions and being worried about getting found out. I wished I'd never employed this stupid girl. Back in my kitchen, I had a nice box for the baby and a bottle of milk made up from powder. The way I saw it, I'd only be gone a few minutes, and she'd be fine with Elsie for that short time. As I laid her down, the baby looked up with her big china blue eyes, just like her sister Venetia's, and I briefly wondered what it would be like to be a mother, to have such a lamb. I might have been a mother if that stupid Ida didn't get pregnant and force Geoffrey to marry her instead of me. He didn't even have proof it was his, the fool that he was. He could have asked me to help. I'd have sorted her out well and proper.
"I know what you're up to, and I want none of it,"
Elsie suddenly announced, lifting up the baby.
"I'm taking her back to her mum."
"No, you're ruddy well not," I said, snatching the baby back and returning her to the box. "You'll stay here and do as you're told, or you won't get a penny off me."
"I don't care about the money. It's wrong, it is."
She brought a hanky to her little nose and blew it loud as a baby elephant, her pretty eyes begging me.
"Can't you see that? Can't you give it back?"
"It's being done for the right and proper reasons, and that's all you need to know," I told her.
"Well, I'm not having any of it,"
she sniffed.
"I'm going back to the manor."
"You'll do no such thing." I stood between her and the door. "I can't have you ruining my plan."
She tried to barge past me.
I could hear the faint caterwauling of Hattie in labour next door and panicked that everything was about to collapse around me. "I'll let you go if you promise not to tell anyone." She pondered for a moment.
"I'll not mention a word, provided you give me my 5 quid.
I seethed. It's completely immoral to demand money for a service she'd failed to finish. But like Hercules, overcoming another obstacle, I reached into my black bag for the money. "You keep your mouth shut or it'll be curtains." She snatched the money away and barged past me into the sunshine. I fretted about what she'd say to Mrs. Winthrop, but then I imagined her dainty throat between my hands and focused on the task at hand, grabbing my bag and hurrying off to Hattie's, leaving the baby girl to fend for herself in the box. After a few knocks, I let myself in to find Hattie slumped by the door, moaning loudly. I leapt down to her and checked her. Thank God the baby was still moving around inside. I prayed it was the boy I needed. Once I'd helped her up to bed, she moaned and strained, the baby refusing to budge. That's when I began panicking about the baby girl in the box in my kitchen. She would need milk by now, but I couldn't get away from Hattie, who held my hand with a vice-like grip. Would she be all right? At last Hattie's screams grew almost inhuman, and I felt panic rising. What would happen if she didn't have a boy? Would the brigadier have me disposed of in some gruesome way? I was petrified as a ferret in a snare by the time the baby eventually squirmed its way out. But the surge of joy! It was a boy! "It's a girl!" I announced.
"Let me see her, let me hold her!"
Hattie cried, leaning forward and trying to grasp the baby from my arms.
"No, she's not breathing properly. I need to take her to my house to resuscitate her with my mechanical ventilator."
Hattie screamed.
"My baby!"
She was on him, dragging the blanketed little fellow out with all her might. Scared to damage the baby, yet adamant to salvage the plan, I yanked him back with a lunging turn towards the door. "I have to go," I screamed, pushing her back on the bed with a firm shove. Her screams of "No!" echoed through the house as I surged down the stairs and out the door, not knowing what I'd find when I got back to my house. The horror of finding the baby girl dead, white, blue and stiff, her big eyes glazed like a doll's. Or maybe stupid Elsie had called the police and I'd find the village matrons gathered to witness my downfall. But the house was ominously quiet. My heart began to race. I am not the most saintly of people, I know, but I couldn't bear to have caused the death of a baby. The vision of her lying dead in the box came to me, and I dashed for the kitchen. I could hardly breathe as I looked into the box. There she was, pale and limp, her eyes closed. This couldn't happen. My hand darted her neck to feel her pulse. I felt a faint fluttering, and she opened her toothless mouth as wide as a baby hippo and let out an ear-piercing screech. I took her out of the box and thrust the bottle of milk into her gob. "Don't you worry, baby girl," I muttered to her. "You're about to have the most adoring mother this side of London." I placed the boy baby in the box, fitting a blanket around him as he seemed a scrawny kind of lad, the type to catch a chill. Then, scooping the girl back up, I headed back to Hattie's. Hattie was just inside the front door, desperate for me to return, still in her bloody nightdress, her dark curls wet and matted. "Is she all right?" she cried, panic on her face. "Is she going to be all right?" "Yes," I smiled. "She's going to be fine." I handed the baby into her outstretched arms, and she gazed at the perfect little face with blue, blue eyes and a little pointed chin, a coating of pale blonde hair over her head. She truly was an exceptionally beautiful baby. And take it from me, most of them aren't. The afterbirth came promptly with a little help, and after promising to be back as soon as I could, I wrenched myself away to deal with the boy. I could hear him bawling as soon as I opened the door, the little bugger, and had to stuff his mouth with a bottle as soon as I got to him. I took him in my arms, bottle and all, and headed for the door. But as I was nipping onto the green, I saw a group of women in the square. It was the WVS ladies just off the bus from Litchfield, Mrs. B holding forth with Mrs. Quayle and the dreaded Tilling woman.
"Lovely day,"
she said cheerfully as she spotted me trying to creep back inside.
"Yes, glorious weather,"
I enthused, concealing the baby inside my coat. "I'll have to get my hat." I disappeared in, grabbed my hat, and knew there was nothing else for it. I was going to have to stuff the baby into my black bag and hope he didn't jolt around too much. I emptied the contents and the crumbs at the bottom, put the baby inside, trying to balance the bottle against his mouth, and crept out once again. The women were thick in discussion, and I decided to make a dash for it across the green.
"Hello there, Miss Pawtree,"
Mrs. Tilling called as I darted to the lane.
"You should have been with us today for the meeting."
"We were just saying how uplifting it was," added Mrs. Quayle, her round face puce with pleasure.
"Oh, how marvellous,"
I said, keeping a distance. A crowd had gathered outside the shop, all in green uniforms like pecking budgies, and I was stuck listening to their nonsense for a few minutes. It was ridiculous. How a bunch of women can honestly believe that a cake sale and some raggedy sewing can win a war, I have no idea.
"Lady Worthing was there," Mrs. B preened. "We have been so fortunate to have her as our benefactor."
The baby boy in the black bag began snivelling, quietly at first and then louder, and I knew I had to leave, now.
"Miss Dash,"
I said, making off.
"What was that noise?"
Mrs. Tilling said with a start, looking around the green.
"Oh, the ducks are such a menace at this time of year," I said cheerily. "They keep me up half the night with their mating rituals," I added with some quick thinking.
"Oh," she said primly. I'm sure she'd consider any allusions to reproduction inherently coarse. Only then a distinct baby's cry came from my black bag, and she glared at it, her mouth open to speak yet unable to decide what to say. I strode off faster than a hen escaping the pot, petrified the woman would start asking questions. But as I rushed up the lane, with the boy's vocal cords reaching a fine volume, I knew that I could corroborate any questioning with a half-truth of sorts. I would say that the baby in my bag had been Mrs. Winthrop's son, who I had whisked to my house for resuscitation. On returning him to his mother, I felt it best to keep him hidden so that she could see him first, before the village folk. Yes, it was perfect. No one would suspect a thing. When I reached Chilbury Manor, I took the baby out before knocking at the side door. It wouldn't be considered proper for a midwife to be going around with newborns in bags. The door was promptly opened by Kitty, of all people, the little evacuee brat hanging around in the background. "Where have you been?" she demanded in a way that made me wonder if she knew somehow. Could she have intuitively guessed the whole thing? Did she understand her father well enough and me sufficiently to fathom the entire scheme? Her big eyes glanced from me to the baby to the black bag and back again, the scowl stiff on her face like I'd ruined her life. I shook my head briefly to remember the right storyline.
"The baby is alive! Why did it take so long?"
she muttered, leading me through the grand entrance and up the marble staircase to the long gallery.
"What could you possibly have been doing?"
"It took as long as it did," I said crossly. I wasn't so scared of Kitty, you see. I was in her father's employ after all. He would get her to shut up if need be. So perhaps I wasn't as cautious as I could have been. I might have made a big error there. Kitty is close as clams with the Tilling woman. Mrs. Winthrop was still in bed, snivelling in her usual way when I handed her the whimpering baby boy with his dark fluff of hair. The perfect family.
"Dear, dear little boy," she crooned, bringing him to her chest. "How can I ever repay you for saving his life, Miss Poultry?"
"The Brigadier will pay what's due," I said with the best smile I could muster. I could hear Kitty sniff moodily beside me, the nosy evacuee girl watching with a keen interest.
"What are you going to call him?"
"His name will be Lawrence Edmund," she smiled.
"Edmund, after our dear lost son."
That set her off weeping again. I didn't want to mess it up now, the end so clearly in sight, so I checked the afterbirth and waited patient like I was the queen herself, and when it had calmed down I promised to visit in the morning and backed out of the room. Nipping down the back stairs and into the kitchen, I was heading for the door, for freedom, when who should turn up but Elsie.
"I know your game," she sneered.
There was no one around, so I took her by the scruff of her maid's uniform and pulled her close. "You'd better not breathe a word, or you'll be found in Bull's End Brook before you know it." I let go, and she fell back onto the floor. Trembling she was, so I think I did a worthy job. Threatening has always been a skill of mine. Stepping over her, giving a small kick for good measure, I headed for the door, and with a sharp tug of the handle I was out in the open at long ruddy last, skipping for joy down the drive, one hand carrying my now empty black bag, the other waving around wildly like a jubilant cowboy. "I'd done it! I'd escaped ambush, gotten over hurdles, avoided pitfalls, and arrived victorious, baby swapped, both mothers happy, and me wealthy, the hero of the day." No one else could have done it, Clara. I swear there's not a woman out there who could have made it through the way I did, always keeping calm, using my quick thinking. The rest of my well-earned money will be with me within the week, and I will be on my way to you, Clara, to begin our new life together. Edwina.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Friday the 3rd of May, 1940. Dear Angela, you owe me cocktails at the Ritz, my dear, as I have won our little bet. Mr. Slater, who I now call Darling Alistair, has joined the throng of admirers who worship the ground I walk on. I knew I could do it, given some time, although I have to confess that this one was quite resistant. It took some of my more sophisticated moves to prompt action. But now he's mine. And what a man he is. I never dreamt he'd be so fascinating. He's transformed his sitting room into a studio. He has the house next to Hattie's on Church Row, and it's crammed with canvases and oils and piles of paintings. Every evening he lights candles and paints while we listen to the wireless. One night they played All of Me, and we danced around like we were in a tiny ballroom of our very own, spinning through a haze of flickering lights as if in a different world. But listen,
This gets scandalous. I've been such a naughty girl, even by your standards. Having seduced him in the stable last weekend, all raw and naked in the hay just as I had planned, I slipped out of work early yesterday and surprised him at his studio. Luckily, he wasn't busy, just trying to mend some typewriter contraption. So I began flipping through his pictures. I didn't know what to expect, but my eyes almost popped out of my head. Weird shapes plastered with clashing colours, blacks and greys and yellows, violins sliced in half and deranged, figures made monstrous with mutations and distortions. "What's this supposed to be?" I asked him, wondering if he hadn't finished it properly.
"It's modern art, darling," he said, chuckling. "It's all the rage in the continent, and London, too."
Then I came across a smaller sketched image, a single nude, an almost transient figure, blurred with charcoal as she flew wisp-like across the page. "I say," I said nonchalantly, "who's she?" He pondered for a moment.
"A girl I knew in London."
She was well-formed, agile, but there was an urgency about her, her head glancing back over her shoulder, as if she were being pursued. He was staring at her, as if remembering something. Who was this girl? You know me, Angie. I can't bear a man to prefer someone else. So I hastily put the picture back in the collection and gave him a saucy smile. "Why don't you paint me like that?" The room had become stifling with warmth, sunshine bursting in through the little windows, sparkles of dust spinning endlessly through the air. "I want you to paint me, so you can always remember how I look right now, before I'm old. Come on." I twirled in front of him. He laughed.
"Venetia, I really don't think. It's not what girls like you do. You're the Brigadier's daughter, after all."
"Stuff that! If I say it's all right, then that's that!" I went to the mirror above the fireplace and let down my hair. "That girl did it? Why can't I?"
"That girl was..."
He paused, searching for the right word.
"She wasn't at all like you, Venetia."
"You mean she wasn't respectable?" I glanced over my shoulder at him, shaking down my hair.
"I mean she was different. She was a bohemian, mixed in different circles. She was older than you."
"I'm 18, you know."
"I know."
"We don't need to tell anyone, or show anyone," I said. "It'll be our little secret."
"There's a wild gleam in your eye, Venetia,"
he said, coming and toying with a strand of hair on my neck. "There always is," I smirked. "It's one of my greatest charms." You know how I get when I have my mind set, and there was something about his refusal that was goading me on, making me do and say things. I had to show him that I was just as daring, just as sophisticated as his city girls. And to be so incredibly naughty, posing nude is far more risque than sex, don't you think? Just imagine what my father would have to say. I began slowly removing my clothes. First one shoulder, and then the other. And before long, my dress was flung to the floor. Then, I began slipping off my petticoat and peeling down my stockings. I knew it was having an effect, as he folded up his collection and watched me with a smile.
"All right, my little minx. You shall have your nude."
He attached a clean canvas onto his easel and began selecting the paints. I draped myself on the thick crimson rug in front of the fireplace, lying on my side, my legs tucked slightly, somewhat modest and yet magnificently naked. It was such a freedom, lying there without a jot on, his eyes flickering over me every few moments, focusing on my body in a way that I've never encountered. Parts of my body normally clothed felt the softness of the rug, the freshness of the breeze from the window. Exposure. It was heaven. Yet as he painted, I felt his attention floating away, as if he were in a different world, listening to the news on the wireless, an intent frown over his face. For an artist and a pacifist,
He takes an unhealthy interest in the war. His ears seem on continual alert for news, especially now that the Nazis are pushing us out of Norway. Am I mad, Angie? Is this all too absurd of me, to go falling in love with an unknown stranger? Having my portrait painted nude? I laugh when I think of what Daddy would say if he ever found out, which, of course, he won't. I wish you were here. You could see for yourself what an incredible man Alistair is. I know this started out as a little bit, but I never expected it would turn into... Well, one never knows how these things end, does one? All I know is that he's done something to me, Angie. It's as if he's reached deep inside me and grabbed hold of my heart. Write again soon and give me more advice, Angie, darling. Oh, I almost forgot to say... Mama has given birth to a very scrawny and highly vocal baby boy. Everyone's ecstatic, as you would imagine, especially Daddy, who needed his male heir, and Mama, who needed to keep Daddy happy. But as a matter of fact, the little baby is a godsend for me, too, keeping everyone so busy that no one knows where I am and what I'm doing. From now on, Angie, I'm free to live my life to the full. Much love, Venetia.
Letter from Miss Edwina Pawtry to her sister Clara. Three Church Road, Chelbury, Kent. Saturday, 4th of May, 1940. Dear Clara, I'm as flustered as a bluebottle in a jam jar. I can't believe it has all led to such a catastrophe. There I was late last night, settling in for the evening after an exhausting day, when there was a sharp knock at the door. Tell me how it happened. It was the Tilling woman storming over from Hattie's house to accost me. Why did the baby stop breathing? Reluctant to bring her into my house, where she might want to see the mechanical ventilator that wasn't there, I insisted that we go round to Hattie's to go over the details. She seemed to want to discuss it in private. Accuse me more like it. It's only right that Hattie's present if we're speaking about her, I said, shoving her back down the path. There's no arguing with that, and I knew it. Hattie was in a fresh pink nightgown, dividing her time between our conversation and the baby, whose name is Rose, I was informed. I'm rather tired, you know, I said in a huffy manner, hovering close to the door of Hattie's little sitting room so I could make a clean getaway. Two births in one day, you see. Although the Winthrop baby was easier, it being her fourth. Mrs. Tilling was watching me in rapt interest, seeping up every gesture, scrutinising it for any slip-ups. Yes, and all on the day I was in Lichfield, she snipped. Then she turned to Hattie. I'm sorry I couldn't have been here to help you through it all. I could see that she felt genuinely guilty for taking the day off to go to the WVS meeting. I shouldn't have left you. She looked back over to me, a storm cloud coming over her face, although I thought Hattie might have gone on another week or more. I felt a stab of panic that Hattie had told her about the brown bottle, the smell of the grimy green mulch lurking inside. You can't blame yourself. The WVS needs you too. You do such marvellous work for us all. But when I was gone, there was an emergency, she stammered. And I couldn't be here in your hour of need, Hattie. I thought she might burst into tears, which would round off my day like a thwack around the ankles with a dead rat. Tell me how it happened, Miss Pawtry. Tell us how you got the baby breathing. Well... When babies are born, I usually give them a little smack, and off they go, crying and all. But this little one... I leaned across and stroked the soft little cheek in the crook of Hattie's arm. This little one didn't cry at all. It really was incredibly fortunate that I was there and knew what to do. And, of course, I had the right equipment. I swept my hands together as if concluding that my experience was worth 100 times Mrs. Tilling's. Silence hung in the air for a few moments. And then Hattie began weeping. I know that pregnancy and motherhood make women prone to tears, but Hattie has no thought for others. I wanted to give her a good hard slap and tell her to pull herself together. The baby's fine now. She should be happy she got the pretty one.
Mrs. Tilling then insisted that I give her a blow-by-blow account of the long, laborious birth. She was new to the midwife game and appeared enthusiastic to learn, and I decided it was education that was driving her rather than gathering details against me. Until the very end, that is. After we'd gone through the whole thing several times, I once again announced that I'd had a long day and really needed to be getting home. "I'll walk you to the door," Mrs. Tilling said, getting up and leading the way into the hallway. She held the front door open, and I walked out into the peaceful night air, thinking for a wondrous moment that the ordeal was over. It was dark, the ducks turning in for the night, seeking out a comfy spot on the edge of the pond. A cool, grassy breeze made me pull my cardigan close.
"I have just one more question for you," Mrs. Tilling said, stepping out behind me onto Hattie's path. "I want to know about the medicine you gave Hattie this morning."
"Oh, that," I said. "It's for tiredness, but I suppose she didn't need it after all."
"Could I have a look at it?"
"No, you can't," I snapped, and then pulling myself together added, "It was used up, so I threw the bottle away."
"Can I see the empty bottle?"
"No," I stammered, quashing down a panic that whipped up my throat like a poisonous snake. "I think I must have left it at the manor." She pondered.
"Don't you think it may have been the reason she went into labour? She wasn't supposed to be giving birth for another week."
"I'm not sure," I said. "She may have got her dates wrong. The baby is a fine size for her small frame and perfectly formed. She was definitely ready to come out today, if not sooner. I've seen it happen dozens of times, dates all mixed up." I looked at her, smiling as if to emphasize my superior understanding of such things, especially with first-timers. I looked at my front door. "I really need to get home now." I gave her a final pat on the arm, then headed down the path. Once inside my own house, I leant against the door for support and slid down onto the floor, lying there for a while, curled up in a question mark, exhausted, confused, and, I have to admit it, scared. It's clear that the Tilling woman smells something fishy. I only hope she doesn't speak to Mrs. Winthrop about her birth. Having two births the same day with the same minor emergency will almost certainly rouse suspicion. Why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I think of so many things? I was stupid enough to think this would be simple as cracking a rooster's neck. I should have been planning, thinking about how I could cover my tracks. At least I know that proof will be almost impossible. You'll have to piece a lot more together to make the whole story. It makes me feel all tied up in knots to think that I could be at the mercy of this wretched woman. Oh, the brigadier. I know he'd have to step in for me if the Tilling woman brings the law into it. After all, it'd be his moth-eaten backside on the line, too. But if he gets wind that Mrs. Tilling suspects, then I'll never see the other half of my money, and I'll have him on my back as well. I'd had enough of it all, and tried to forget about it and get on to bed. Except I keep hearing Hattie's cries in my head, screaming at me not to take her baby. I will carry on as usual for now, keep my head down and wait for the money from the brigadier. But the whole thing has given me the willies, and you must promise me to burn this letter as soon as you've read it. The walls have ears these days. Until I have more news, Edwina.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Friday, the 10th of May, 1940. Today the Nazis invaded Holland and Belgium. I feel almost numb with horror, the sheer brutality and viciousness of these people. Now that they're so much closer to us, they'll almost certainly be using the air bases in Holland and Belgium to make raids over England, especially over us in the southeast. France will be invaded next, and after that? Our Prime Minister, Mr. Chamberlain, has stepped down because he underestimated Hitler, tried to appease him, and it is said that Mr. Churchill will replace him. We all know that Churchill wants to take us into all-out war, regardless of the fact that they're bigger and stronger and likely to win. Doesn't he remember the millions of men killed in the last one? What about David? Will his life be wasted on a battlefield because of some idiotic notion that we have to try?
Winston Churchill will be much better for this war, Mrs. B chortled when we met at the shop. It's such a ruthless old bulldog, the Nazis are petrified of him. He's the only one who can win it.
But he can't stop them. They'll overrun us, like they're overrunning everyone else. Surely it's better if